Thanks very much, Bronwyn, and thanks for the opportunity to present here. I was just saying a few minutes ago, whenever you get invited to one of these things, you think, well, what am I going to say? I've just had an interview with Alec a month ago. I've got to come up with something original. But these days, with these markets doing what they're doing, I feel like I almost need to rush out halfway through the presentation and see what's happening, because things are changing thick and fast. So I've got quite a few slides. I'm going to race through them, but there's lots of pictures, so hopefully it makes it a little bit more interesting. And what I'd like to talk about today is the importance of cycles. Okay, cycles are just a fact. They are all around us. We all know about the water cycle and the carbon cycle and the lunar cycle and the business cycle. Cycles are everywhere. The problem is when times are good for a long time, we forget that we're in a cycle. You know, you arrive at Hermanus, you have three beautiful sunny days, you think it's going to be sunny forever, boom. You know, you wake up the next morning and it's rain. So cycles are just a fact, but in financial markets, ever more so. Now, this I always think is quite an interesting one, the psychological pitfalls of the market cycle. And who hasn't been here if you've bought a share? You know, you buy a share, you're filled with optimism, and then it goes up and now you're excited and it goes up a bit more. And so you start extrapolating and think, well, you know, at some point I'm going to be able to sell this stake and buy a wine farm. You got euphoria. And you hold when it tops out. Let me just see what's going on here. You're complacent. And then it falls a bit more and you go, well, hang on, that's a bit irritating. But anxious, and then denial and fear and panic. And if you don't sell, because normally what happens is right at the bottom people sell. And then it goes up and then you go, no, this is just a dead cat bounce. But this is quite important. And so emotions and psychology are very much a factor in financial markets. And it's not just about PE ratios. It's understanding the psychology behind, you know, how many buyers there are, how many sellers there are, etc. Recommendations, how recommendations change. And so this again is the cycle. Now, you heard Corky yesterday mention Howard Marks in one of his favorite books, The Most Important Thing. And I completely agree. Howard Marks is an absolute superstar and a brilliant and eloquent speaker. So do yourself a favor and go onto YouTube and look up Howard Marks. I think he did a Google Talks a few years ago. And brilliant. But Howard Marks has got a book called Mastering the Market Cycle, Getting the Odds on Your Side. And because that is what we're trying to do. You know, we can't forecast the future. It's unforecastable. People who tell you this is what's going to happen, they either, you know, in the words of, I think it was Kenneth Galbraith, there are two types of forecasters, those who know they don't know and those who don't know that they don't know. Okay. So we can't forecast the future. So the best we can do is get the odds on our side. And Howard Marks has come up with three stages of the market cycles. The first is when a few unusually perceptive people believe things will get better. The second stage is when most investors realize that things are actually getting better. And the third and final stage is when everyone thinks that things are going to be better forever. Okay? And so whenever you're looking at something, and that's be it Bitcoin, be it markets, be it the Rand, etc., you know, always ask yourself, where are we in the cycle? And I find that quite useful. So let's take a step back into history. And this is the MSCI World ex-USA. So it's all in the World Index. MSCI World Index is all developed markets. So it's all developed markets outside the USA. Started at 100 back in 1970. It's nearly 9,000. So this is ex-USA. That compound return has been 8.5% per annum. And you'd think, well, inflation over that period hasn't averaged anywhere close to 8.5% per annum. People who've invested outside the USA have got wealthy in real terms. And so that's great. But let's go and have a look at the USA. And remember, that number was just under 9,000. Well, here's the 100 for the USA, MSCI USA total return. What do we mean by total return? It's the dividends reinvested. So it includes the dividend income. Well, that's gone from 100 to almost 18,000. And you think, okay, well, is that double the return? No, it's only 10% per annum. And you heard Corky mention that number yesterday. So it shows you the impact of compounding. There's only a 1.5% difference, okay, but compounded over a long period of time makes a big difference. Of course, the timing of when these markets did well is interesting. And so let's go and have a look on a 5-year rolling period. a basis, because we didn't all invest in 1970, so that's all academic. How would we have done on a five-year rolling basis? This is ex-USA. The red line going through it is the average, 8.5. And what you can see, there were some periods, coming back to cycles, which were well above the average. There were some well below the average, even negative, okay? And we're a little bit below the average over the long period now. Let's look at the USA. There we go. You can see a similar thing. There's the 10% average through time, but there were some periods when it was below 10%, some when it was well above, some when it was negative. Okay. And more recently, been very positive, 15%. You know, if you invested 5 years ago, and 15%, you saw what the numbers did when you compounded 10%. 15% is a big number. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the USA performance, 5 year rolling USA, minus the ex-USA. Okay, to show you the difference, had you invested in one region or not. And what do you see? You see cycles. There were some periods when the USA did, so if you're below the 0%, all right, the USA underperformed. If you're above the 0%, USA outperformed. There were some periods when USA did well, some when it didn't do well, comes back to cycles. What do we see on the far right? It's been a long period when the USA has done much better than being outside the USA, okay? And I think we're at that point where everyone thinks, and you come back to this American exceptionalism, everybody thinks the USA is going to do better forever. That's where we are. You can see the block, and there's a reason I've highlighted that block, and that's basically going back to 2015. And here's why I've highlighted that block, because these are passive flows. These are flows into passive investments, the S&P 500, the QQQ, etc. Okay. Now, you know, when I started out, there was less than $1 trillion in passive investments. And I think there's now about $12 trillion in passive investments. And I started in 2008. I started the company in 2008. So, given that what we know about human psychology and the fact that everybody chases recent returns, where do we think all these passive investors put the money? They put the money in the US. And here are the largest funds. Here are the largest passives. You know, State Street's S&P 500, Vanguard's S&P 500, the iShares S&P 500, 609, 605, NASDAQ 100, okay? $2.5 trillion just in S&P 500 stocks. Why? Because that's what's been doing well recently. Okay. To put that into perspective, how much is in the Vanguard Value Fund? 135. Why? Oh, value. Who knows value? I mean, value hasn't done well. Just want to be in the Mag 7. I mean, I know an instance where I've got a friend who's a fund manager of a small and mid-cap ex-USA. Okay. Small and mid-cap companies outside the USA. And they had a client last year who said, that's it, we're done, we're redeeming everything. And they said, what are you going to do with the money? We're putting it in a Mag 7 ETF. Okay? So it got to that point where everyone just capitulates. This is going to go on forever. These companies are the big ones, and they're the giants, and so be it. Right. So when you put all that together, and that the USA has been doing well, and that's passive flows and active flows, etc., it's no surprise that today in the world index, North America is some 73% of the index. And all these other countries, Asia ex Japan, so that's effectively Korea and Hong Kong and Australia, you know, a couple of percent. Japan, 5%. I mean, Japan's smaller than some of the weightings of the largest company in the world index. Now, when I started, and you'll see a chart a little bit later, when I started at university, you know, that was, Japan was the place to be. You had just in time. We had all these amazing products, Sony and Toyota, and these guys were taking over the world. That's now smaller than one or two companies in the S&P, in the MSCI World Index. Okay, so it shows you how things have changed. But this is the state of play today. Most people have most of their money, if you're a global investor, in US stocks, and most of their money in the same stocks. Okay. Now, this is Sir John Templeton, one of the best investors who ever lived. You know, I wrote a LinkedIn piece a little while ago, and he compounded at some 16% for 40 years or thereabouts. And he had a great quote. Bull markets are born on pessimism. They grow on skepticism. They mature on optimism, and they die on euphoria. When everybody thinks this is it, this is the way to go, that's the end. Okay, the last buyer, and think about it, the last buyer has bought. You know, and if you think about where did this bull market start in 2009? I mean, I remember going to the States in 2009, walking around San Francisco because I was at a conference, and I mean, the streets were desolate. They were empty. I thought, whew, maybe this is the end of the world. So, you know, even me back then, there was so much pessimism. What does that mean? It means everyone's sold. You know, the selling has happened. It's done. The last seller's sold. And so where are we today? Well, euphoria. Okay, let's just think about this. You know, Trump's going to get elected. We're going to have less regulation. We're going to have lower taxes. That's going to be great for corporate profits. It's going to be amazing. It's going to take over the world, etc. Trump elected. Okay, no surprise. Bitcoin, the day that Bitcoin peaked was the day of the inauguration. Okay, there we come back to that euphoria. So euphoria. And what does that, what happened there? Well, this is a chart from the Federal Reserve and Goldman Sachs. I got it out of a weekly publication called CIS. And early in 2025, you know, you can see the weighting of financial asset allocation to households, mutual funds, pension funds, basically all-time high. Okay, how much have they got in cash? Practically nothing. How much have they got in bonds? Almost nothing. Okay, or very low weighting relative to history. All right, so that's one another example of euphoria. Everybody has bought. The last buyer has bought, maybe. Well, there's an ETF called MAGS. And what is that? That's just the MAG 7. 40% of their assets flowed in December. 40% of all their assets flowed in December. Okay, one ETF. So you can just see there were just the signs of euphoria. Okay, stage three, when everyone concludes, things will get better forever. That's where I think, you know, the signs are certainly that is what's happened in the U.S. Have a look at the markets today. NASDAQ, I think, is down 8% year to date. Okay, Europe's up 15%. Brazil was down 30% last year. Who wants emerging markets? Brazil is up double digits this year. China, forget about China. China's up 18%. So all these people who poured money in the last moments of last year based on Trump and elections and things like that, they're underwater. Okay, so where everyone concludes things will get better. Now, why is it going to change? Well, I think there are a few reasons why it could change. And everyone asks, well, what's the catalyst? The first reason, I mean, this is from The Economist a couple of weeks ago, you know, Trump pouring money about to set fire to the dollar. I mean, he is out there making enemies with his closest neighbors. And on a daily basis, you know, you've seen the news, you know, tariffs are on, tariffs are off. It's hard to keep up. And those are, he's imposing tariffs with his neighbors, America's neighbors and closest allies. And I mean, you know, I think he'd been inaugurated for a week and he'd alienated the Canadians, the Chinese, the Danish, the rest of Europe, you know, so in South Africa in not a long time. So foreign and international investors have now got a reason to sell. All right. The second thing is the popularity. I mean, that's the popularity. With what Canadians, their perspective and how many think that the Americans are their friend, it's down to 24%. But this is a YouGov poll, and you can see a whole lot of countries where they less favorable views to North America. That was in Feb. That was before the White House and how Trump treated you, you know, President Zelensky, etc. I mean, I hate to think what it's like now. So around the world, people have now got a reason to sell the dollar. Okay. And what have we got here? This is the Tesla share price. It's the market cap. Now, Tesla's down 50% since the post-inauguration benefits. Okay. Down 50%. Tesla sales in Europe are cratering. You know, France down 63%, Germany down 60%. There are protests outside Tesla depots and all around the world. I'd be surprised how many. It's still going to carry on. You know, those were orders. So the numbers in the next few months are going to be horrific. And Tesla, even after its 50% fall, is still on 105 times earnings. It's the 12th biggest company. If you buy an S&P 500, your 12th biggest company is Tesla, even after that fall. Okay, so prices are in free fall. What does that mean? It means the leasing companies don't know how to value this. So what are they going to do? Well, they go, okay, well, we're either not going to provide finance for a Tesla, or we're going to charge punitive rates because we don't know what this thing's going to be worth in a couple of years' time. And so that's a big company in the S&P 500. You look at companies like Apple, you know, and what's going on in China, it's by China. And so Apple's sales are 20%, 20% of Apple sales are in China. All right. So a lot going on. Another important point I haven't really seen much talked about until this morning when I went onto Google on my iPhone, and you know how it follows what you like. There was an article in, I think it's Forbes or Fortune, I think it's Forbes, by Ray Dalio talking about this thing. These are the major foreign holders. Sorry, let me just go back here for a second. These are major foreign holders of U.S. Treasury securities, okay? China's the second largest holder of U.S. Treasuries. Canada, I think, is number six. You got most European countries down there. Now, if the foreign countries don't want to buy U.S. debt, you know, what's that going to mean? It means interest rates are going to go up in the States. What is that going to mean? It means corporate profits are going to be less. So there's lots of uncertainty out there. Who knows how that's going to play out? Depends on inflation, depends on the exposure, etc. But there could easily be, if these trade wars carry on, some ramifications. And how different is that to what we thought, all that people thought, about the state of euphoria when Trump got elected? Okay, so what do we got here? Here's the euro. The euro's up. You know, so the Japanese yen is up. So now if you own, you saw Japan was the biggest holder of foreign U.S. debt securities. Interest rates are now rising in Japan. There's less of a reason to own U.S. debt as a Japanese insurance company. And you're losing money because the dollar's weakening. Okay. So lots at play. I mean, there you can see the euro. No one's excited about the euro. No one's interested in sterling, etc. Maybe we're at the end of stage three as well. So the second reason is valuations are high. Now, you often see PE multiples in various regions, and you can see that the US is very high. What I've done here is I've taken, rather than a price to earnings ratio, I've taken an enterprise value. And what is enterprise value? It's the market cap, so it's the value of the company, plus its net debt. So it brings into account the balance sheets of these companies. You know, if you buy a company for 100, but it's got 50 of cash, well, effectively, I'm only paying 50. But if I buy a company and it's 100 and it's got 50 of debt, well, actually, I'm paying 150 because I'm taking on that liability. Okay? So enterprise value brings into play the debt. And what you can see on the far right there is U.S. large growth. You know, it was, you can see in 2009, all similar levels. But large growth is in a world of its own on the far right. Whatever you see right down the bottom there, that is Japanese companies, you know. So Japanese companies, they had a tough time. You'll see they were the largest component of the world index back in the late 80s. They had the crash. The companies got very conservative and just started hoarding cash. And so whenever there were profits, they just kept the cash, paid off the debt. You've now got a situation today where lots of Japanese companies have got piles of cash. And we've got some companies in the portfolio where they've got more cash and investment securities than the value of the company. You know, it's like buying a dollar for 50 cents. So that's right down at the bottom. And that's what I wanted to show, because you don't see that in a PE ratio with the Japanese companies. But you can see the US large cap growth are in a world of their own. Okay. Now, valuations matter. So what have we got? Here's a JP Morgan, and it's a great chart book, actually. You can go on there, you can search for this. Every month they update it. And what you have on the x-axis is price earnings ratio. And on the y-axis is the subsequent one-year return. And so what does it show you? All these little dots. And you can see where we are at the moment, the orange triangle. What it shows you is that over the next year, valuations mean nothing. Okay. There have been some years when you've had the valuation level where we are here, all right, where there's been negative 30% returns, and some year where there's been a high PE and a valuation and you've had a return of 40%. So over 1 year means nothing. But who's a one-year investor? This is over 5 years. And what do you see here? The more you pay, okay, the more you move across on the x-axis, the lower your returns. And so right now, this suggests, if history holds true, people who invest in the US should expect very low returns, like 1-2%. And Howard Marks said that not long ago. Okay, so you know, you invest maximum euphoria, you've got high profit margins. Okay, so what is a price earnings ratio? It's the price on earnings. But earnings are high. When did you want to invest? You want to invest when earnings are low. Okay, then you had low PE on low earnings. That's just, you had the magic. Now you've got a high PE on high earnings. These tariffs are going to drag these earnings down. Okay, and you've got a high PE on those high earnings. Now the earnings start falling. Everyone goes, why am I paying 30 times earnings for a company that's barely growing? We've seen that with Walmart. Okay, look at the chart of Walmart in recent days, or Costco. Fantastic companies, but Costco's on 60 times earnings. Walmart's on 30 times earnings. These things are barely growing. Okay, Apple's on 30 times earnings, barely growing. That's why Warren Buffett sold his Apple. So we're at an interesting point in the US. You've got high earnings, high prices, and a lot of uncertainty because of Trump and his tariffs. Okay, and so where around the world is there, you know, here you have the average PEs per regions. You've got world, US, Europe, UK, emerging markets, and China. Well, the US is out on a limb up above here. That, because of the weighting in the world index, you can see the world is up there. All the other regions below historic average. No one's wanted to talk about Europe. Europe's, you know, going to fall apart if you listen to the likes of Nigel Farage and those guys. And because of that, all of a sudden, in the space of a couple of weeks, you've had the new German Chancellor Merz, and he's now going to spend money on defense and infrastructure. And Germany's got a very low debt to GDP. And all of a sudden, hey, maybe Europe's going to grow. Okay, so, and the euro strengthened. People have been pulling money out and putting it into Europe. So very interesting. So this is what I wanted to show you here is Japan. We think it can't happen to the US. Well, history suggests otherwise. Late 87, Japan was 40% of the world index. Where's it now? 5. Where was the US? 30. Where's it now? 66. Comes back to cycles. Okay. Everything happens in cycles. And so how we invested at Ranmore? Well, we're not invested in the world index. You know, we don't worry about the benchmark. If people want to put 3% of their in a company that offers no value because it's in the benchmark, we don't do that. So we are invested around the world in opportunities that we think make sense. And we think that investors can actually, grow the assets. But it's been so hard to keep up with the US that many fund managers have capitulated and thought, okay, well, I don't really like Apple. I don't think it offers value, but it's 5% in the index. I'll just have 4. Well, we don't want 4% in something that we don't think makes sense. And so we're very differently positioned. And arguably today, with what's going on in the world and who knows how these tariffs are going to end up, that's how you want to be positioned. Okay, that's how you want to be diversified. We want to, you know, I was like, when I speak to entrepreneurs who've made a lot of money, you make a lot of money by being focused on your business and all the rest. And then your business does well and you focus. But as you get old, you want to stay rich. And to stay rich, you want to be diversified. And being diversified is not being in Apple, Amazon, Tesla, Microsoft, and Google. That's not being diversified. Okay, so we invest around the world. I mean, there's our returns, 100 rands grown to 1,140. And, you know, we do stand back and look at that and go, well, we're just trying to invest in a way that we think makes common sense. So it is surprising to us that we're so far ahead of competitors, but that's what we do. And those are percentiles. And this is versus the value manager. So it's been, we've done better versus the value index and versus many of our value peers. But again, we just try and do what we think makes sense. So we have, you know, the other thing we like to do is we have a sliding scale management fee. These are very profitable businesses. You know, our assets are up a few fold in recent years, but we don't, if your assets are up 5 times, we don't need 5 times as many staff. And so we want to pass on some of those benefits to clients. So we've just reached $500 million last month. And actually for assets above $500 million, our management fee goes from 0.9% down to 0.75%. So that some of the benefits are passed on to our clients. And so our current TER is 1.1%. And we charge no performance fees. You know, if it's your money, why should I charge a performance fee? You don't pay a performance fee when you go to the dentist and he pulls out the right tooth. So, and then we have a feeder fund, and that is for RAND-based funds. If you know, have got RAs or companies or trusts locally. And actually, we've been approached a number of times, can we run a fund on the side for a wealthy family office, etc.? No, the money all goes in the same pot because then it lowers the fees for everybody. It means we've got a more efficient system and we've got one product and that's it. And so our institutional fees are available via all the platforms. And there we cap the total expense ratio at 1%. And so whatever's left, well, then that's our effective management fee. So we've got a disciplined process. We've seen this, you know, I cut my teeth in the emerging market crises of the late 90s, when I remember Cookie and I were both at Old Mutual at the time, and I came into my, I looked at my iNet and I thought, this is yesterday's watch list, because it was, but yesterday everything was down 7%, but it wasn't. It was this, you know, it was today's, it was down 7% a couple of days in a row. So we've seen this. We like to be conservative. We've got a very diversified portfolio. Conviction is not something we talk about. You can be, have huge conviction in the future. It's a very uncertain time. We're different to our peers. We've received a couple of awards just yesterday or 2 days ago. We got a London Stock Exchange Award for the best global equity fund on a risk-adjusted basis over the last 3 years. And we think that, you know, you want to be diversified. These are uncertain times. So, you know, keep in mind the history of cycles. If you want to follow us, we write a fact sheet. We don't try and talk about what we think the Rand's going to do and what we think gold price is going to do. Try and talk about a company that's done well, a mistake, etc. You can sign up for a on our website for a fact sheet, monthly fact sheet, and yeah, happy to take any questions, Ronan.
Thanks very much, Sean. So let's talk about your Europe allocation, right? 32% in terms of what you've just demonstrated. How do you go about your research for Europe? I mean, we're talking, this is not well-covered territory, and that's probably why your performance is as it is. But how do you stretch your research team to appropriately cover the European ecosystem?
So we're bottom-up investors. And what does that mean? We don't sit around the world and go, okay, where's there going to be the most economic growth? We think it's going to be in Europe. Right, let's go and find some European companies. We build from the bottom up. And we my wife's a doctor. I know there's some doctors in the audience. And it's a bit like, you know, you can diagnose a patient in South Africa. You can diagnose a patient in the UK, in America, etc. You know, so every person has arms, legs, or heart, etc. Every company has an income statement, balance sheet, and cash flow. All right. So we build our portfolio from the bottom up, and we say, we look around the world and we say, where do we think great opportunity, investment opportunities? And for a while now, they've been coming up as Europe. Now, we knew Europe was out of favor because, well, is the economic bloc going to hold together? You had the French snap election. You had uncertainty, you know, the march of the far right. What's that going to do to coalitions? Those are all the fears. But those fears were in the price. That's why there were low prices. Okay, people who were worried about that and sold. And that's why there were low prices. And so you had a situation where you could buy European banks on 9% dividend yields. So you look at this and you go, well, I want to make a double-digit return. If I'm getting 9% from dividends, I only need a little few percent of growth, because where do you get your return from? You get your return from dividends, earnings growth, and re-rating, your PE going from 10 to 12 or whatever. If I'm getting 9% from dividends, I don't need too much earnings growth, and I don't need too much in the way of a PE multiple. Okay, so I can get some earnings growth because these guys are overcapitalized. These banks were overcapitalized because COVID, the European regulator said, right, no dividends, no buybacks, nothing. We don't know how bad this is going to get. So they built up this excess capital, which they hadn't paid out. American companies carried on buying back stock. And so you end up with a situation where you go, well, I think I've got a fantastic opportunity here. I'm buying these companies on half book value, 9% dividend yields, and 5x earnings. Am I buying European? No. Well, some companies. So we've got, and that's all, that's Europe, that's UK. So for example, we've got a company, one of our top 10 holdings, Associated British Foods. And those of you who travel to the UK will know Primark. Okay. In fact, ABF bought Illovo. So what do you have in ABF? You have 50% is Primark, essentially. And the other 50% is Illovo, you know, UK sugar, you've got Twinings tea, you've got Jordan cereals, you've got bread, etc. So it's a well-diversified conglomerate. Okay, but Primark is like Mr. Price. And here you've got a company on 4% dividend yield on 9x earnings. Well, Mr. Price is on what, 15x earnings. So if times are tough, people don't start, they don't buy their underpants at Marks and Spencer's, they buy their underpants at Primark. So you're actually quite positioned. But it's out of favor. Why? Well, because it's a UK retailer. And don't we know times are tough in the UK? So if you the nice thing about being a value investor is you get asymmetry. Okay, you limit your downside because the fear is priced into something, but you've got upside when things go well. And this is a management own of the Weston family owns 50% of this company, and they're buying back stock 9x earnings. Makes sense. And so you're exposed when things come right. Primark around the world is growing double digits, other than the UK. No, we don't worry about the top down. So I'm not trying to. I mean, who can possibly his closest allies don't know what Trump's going to do. But here's the thing. Okay, where's there more economic where political stability in the world, in China or in America? Okay, I mean, look what's going on with.
Sorry, I actually can't answer that question. No, I don't know.
Well, so let me tell you, when we started buying China, what was the fear? Remember, 5 years ago, everybody wanted China. They were launching China funds. China was the place. You had this massive economy, this huge population. They were emerging. Everybody wanted China. Now, last year, they were launching emerging market funds ex-China. You didn't want to mention China. I know for a fact we didn't get selected by a large fund of funds in the UK because we had liked Chinese equities. But it's throwing the baby out of the bathwater. We got lots of Chinese or Hong Kong listed companies with operations in China that started by their founders. The founders are still involved, paying nice dividends, strong balance sheets, and are growing. Okay. So what was the fear? Well, the fear was that Jack Ma disappeared for a few months, and you've got to be careful because China can put pressure on their leaders. But that was before, and this was the insight. That was before the property bubble burst. Okay, they didn't really need the tech companies as much because that lots of employment in their property bubble. Now, property bubbles burst, they need the tech companies for economic growth and job creation. And that's why you saw very recently that the Premier invited the CEOs of the large companies into their office. Now, why are they going to do that and then put the hammer down?
But I just want to understand this. So you believe that there is a sense of stability in China now?
Are we not buying banks? I mean, we're not buying banks. So, and I'm not buying property companies either.
But okay? You know that the regulatory environment can change at the drop of a hat in any of these economies,
But it can change at the drop of a hat in the US. You know, it can change at the drop of a hat in the US. You know, Department of Justice comes out and forces or says to Alphabet, right, you're not paying $20 billion to Apple, okay, to be the de facto search engine. Well, what's that going to do to Apple's profits? So
all right.
But the difference is it's not being priced in the US.
Okay? I understand the principle. I want to, before I hand, and I will hand the mic out, but I'm looking at your February fund note that you referred to. People can sign up for that under Ranmore Fund. Jupiter Asset Management was a mistake, and you detailed that. I loved it when you got off the stage and you said, where we make mistakes. We acknowledge, we learn from them, and then we also celebrate our successes. So I thought it actually pertinent to give us a little indication of Jupiter Asset Management, which let you down in terms of the thesis, and then also Societe Generale, which was positive for you in terms of selling out.
Yeah, so look, us fund managers, and I know fund managers don't like to talk about mistakes, but we're dealing with the future here. Things are uncertain, okay? So the key is when we get it wrong, you don't want to lose too much money. When you get it right, you want to be exposed to the upside. If you pay a high price for, Nike because it's a wonderful company and you like their shoes and you pay 40 times earnings, well, don't be surprised if the thing's, you're down 50%. So you got asymmetry the wrong way. If you buy Novo Nordisk when everybody knows that obesity is a problem and it's a duopoly, et cetera, you pay too much, Novo Nordisk is down 50%. Okay, from its highs. So the question is, what are you paying? Now, asset management industry has been a difficult place to invest. There are obviously lots of asset managers out there because we've been exposed to the passives, the rise of passives, and their low fees. And it's very difficult to charge a higher fee if you're doing the same thing as a passive. If you're going to hug the benchmark, well then, why do people need to invest with you? You can invest in a passive. So assets have been, so asset growth has not, there have been outflows from Jupiter. And from Aberdeen, which is another UK asset manager we're invested in. But the market growth meant that the asset growth was increasing and was offsetting the outflows, right? AI should be very helpful in lowering costs in asset managers. We use AI within our little business. okay, analyzing, you know, numbers and extracting data from annual reports and conference call transcripts and things like that. You can use it. And so what was our thesis? Well, here you had Jupiter, which had half its market cap in cash.
I think it was 220 million pounds.
That's right. Yeah, half its market cap in cash. And they had, there was news of one of their top managers, Ben Whitmore, had left, all right, and was leaving. And so there were some outflows in advance of that. So everybody knew that. It was, you know, 10% dividend yield, half its market cap in cash. You're paying a few times earnings. There was lots they could do. But they released their results and variable costs went up. And I'm going, well, how can variable costs go up when your revenue is falling? Well, because staff costs went up. I go, I'm done. Okay, they're not on my side. You know, how on earth can my staff costs go up when my revenue is falling? This is just poor. And so we sold, but we only lost 6%. Okay, so, you know, we contrast that with SocGen, where I think we almost doubled our money. We were buying after the French, we had a small stake, and then they announced the French snap election, and everybody thought, oh, well, this is a problem. And you had SocGen, you could pick up SocGen on 30 cents in the dollar, and they had a new CEO who seemed to be moving in the right direction, Krupa. And so now all of a sudden everybody wants European banks, and, you know, we sold it more than 100%. So that's the trick. When you get it wrong, you don't lose too much money. And if you get it right, you can do really well, and you compound that through time, that's fine. But if you pay too much for the stories that are out there, if you buy Tesla on 100 times because you think they're wonderful EVs, and then you find out that BYD is eating their lunch, and, you know, Elon Musk's not doing anything for the, then you're exposed to the downside. And that's what we don't want. I wanted to just add one thing on China, because what's the biggest fear right now? What happens if China invades Taiwan? Okay. Well, let me tell you, if China invades Taiwan, you do not want to be owning the S&P 500, because they make all NVIDIA's chips. And China's a big thing in, I mentioned Apple, McDonald's, and all the rest. Okay, so you don't want to be owning US stocks. But I don't think that's a risk, and I should touch a bit of wood here. But because why would China go through the process of stimulating the economy? They've got some measures to stimulate the economy, which are underway right now. If they're going to invade Taiwan next week, surely they wouldn't do that. So that's our thinking on that. So it's a fear. You know, it could happen. But we haven't bet the ranch on China,
diversified portfolio.
Yeah, but we didn't think Russia would invade, and they did, and it cost us 10%. But we recovered.
I'm opening to audience. Let's get some questions from the floor. Thank you. We do have a roving mic, and right up front, yeah, and then into the front here, and then I'm cognizant of that side of the room as well. Please go ahead, sir.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for a very insightful talk. Quick question. So, there's a very fine line between value investing and a value trap. How long do you keep patience with a company when things aren't going well? Because obviously there is the time value to money. So how do you differentiate that? That's my first question. My second question is, what do you say to the fact that in the US, inflation numbers just came out? They were not as hot as expected. They were colder than expected. Is there potentially still a potential for the Fed to drop rates, or will that not happen?
Thanks, Duke. So yeah, you know, every time a company reports, we look and we say, are conditions improving? Is this still offer value? What's our potential upside based on what we think a company is worth from this point? And not even when they report, what is our potential upside? We've got a target price for every company based on what we think it's worth, and we can see daily what that's doing. And so when Alibaba, you know, roared in October last year, we sold it all of it, because we didn't think, because there was better opportunities elsewhere. We weren't going to hang around for the next 3 years hoping that we were going to get the 3% remaining return. And then Alibaba, you know, the excitement faded and it fell back. We bought it back and we just sold it again. So, so we're very valuation sensitive. We are value investors. And so that means we focused on the value. But if things are not going well, you know, when Jupiter comes out and they report the results and we analyze the results and we ask ourselves one question: if we didn't own it, would we buy it today? And if the answer is no, we sell it. And even if I've written about it in the fact sheet last month, I don't care. Okay. You know, we try and avoid behavioral biases. If I go and tell people this is a wonderful company, And then, you know, something happens. You know, you can be reluctant to sell it. In fact, there's a famous investor, I think I'm right in saying it was Guy Speer in Switzerland. I think I'm right in saying he only writes about stocks once he sold them to avoid the behavioral bias of getting involved. Well, I said this, I can't possibly sell it now. You know, we are quite ruthless about that. If we won't own it today, we wouldn't buy it today. We sell it.
He could also only write about the stock because he doesn't want to get it wrong until he's actually made the final call, right?
That's probably right. I don't know. I mean, but that's why we tell people right up front, we're not going to get everything right. So don't look at our top 10 and think, oh, well, they like, you know, Petrobras. We better go buy. That means it's a strong buy. We'll go and buy Petrobras because we could change our mind. We could be wrong on Petrobras. So, you know.
Yeah. In other words, don't copy him, right?
Okay, is it on? Okay.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, Sean, thanks for that. Clarity of thoughts is pretty amazing. So this is the question, your top three or four books that have influenced your way of thinking the most. And the second question is mental models. Which three do you think are underrated and which three are overrated?
Yeah, I mean, which few books? I've read lots of books on investing. It's pretty boring. Can I have a look at my study? I'm reading a good book at the moment by a guy called Dan Rasmussen called The Humble Investor. And that's quite interesting. It talks to the folly of forecasting. You know, there's lots of things. The folly of forecasting. Howard Marks, I mean, I concur with Corky. The most important thing, and the story behind the most important thing is he thought, okay, I'm going to write a book. Okay, what's the most important thing? He started writing. He thought, well, hang on, that's also the most important thing. And then wrote another chapter. And so each chapter is on a different most important thing. So he's been very influential. And actually, we're really lucky these days because you can watch Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger clips on YouTube and all the rest. You know, which other books? I mean, Market Wizards. Some of my gurus, and this is going to sound odd, but I mean, some of my gurus are, you know, Paul Tudor Jones, Bruce Kovner, you know, Stan Druckenmiller. In fact, Stan Druckenmiller was interviewed the other day by Nikolai Tangen from Norges Bank. Really insightful thing. But what you'll hear him say is like, oh, what did George Soros say? I'm rich because I know when I'm wrong. Okay. So, and Stan Druckenmiller is the same thing. He'll bet big. If he gets it wrong, he's like, I've got absolutely no problem with walking away when I get it wrong. What another of the guys ever said is, oh, low turnover is the answer. I think that's the biggest fallacy of the industry is low turnover, because you buy a company, I've got low turnover. Yeah, but if you're sitting in the wrong stock and things are getting worse, why on earth do you want to have low turnover? So we've got a framework, which I think is maybe a little bit of our, you know, recipe that's taken me a long time to. We try and avoid value traps. Okay. And avoiding value traps, one of the best ways to avoid value traps is just saying, you know, conditions improving. Because it's, you know, but it's cheap. No, but that's not the question. Are conditions improving is my first question. Or stable, then I'm interested in how cheap it is. If things are deteriorating, well, it's probably going to get cheaper. That's kind of my one liner. It's quite tricky. You know, you look at it and you go, oh, yeah, but I'm, you know, it's cheap. You go, okay, well, what's my dividend yield? Well, 4%. How am I going to get 5% earnings growth? Well, it's going to be a bit of a push. You just come back to that. Are conditions stable or improving? It's, you know.
Questions from this side of the room? Just can I?
Thanks, Sean. Thanks on America, China, and Europe.
Yeah.
What's your view on like Argentina and Malay and what happens there when the regime changes from an investment perspective? Do you look at it differently?
No, we haven't bought any Argentinian stocks. I mean, I know Repsol, not Repsol, YPF's been amazing. I do find it amazing that everybody celebrates Malay. And what one of the things he did, the first thing he did was to remove tariffs, you know, and lowers, because what do tariffs do? They raise costs. And if you go back to, and I credit, you know, Sandy McGregor from Alan Gray for this thinking, and I try and take like these little nuggets from all these people, but Sandy McGregor, he said, which was the best economics lesson I ever learned, that lower costs drive economic growth. Okay? Because if you've got lower costs, then you've got more money to spend on other stuff. And then when you spend the money on other stuff, then that drives the multiplier effect. So if my bond rate or home loan rate comes down, I've now got more money to go to restaurants. If I go to a restaurant, then I'm paying the waiters, and the restaurateur can go buy from the wholesaler, and the wholesaler can employ people and order stuff, and the logistics companies, etc. So you get the multiplier effect. What do tariffs do? They raise costs. So, you know, would I be surprised about economic growth being disappointing in the States? No. But I'm not a macro forecaster. And sorry, Dirk, I don't answer your question about interest rates. I think, you know, we got to wait for the inflation numbers to come through from all these tariff increases and things like that. So I do find it interesting. Everyone's celebrating Malay, but at the same time, they think, well, these tariffs are a good idea. They're a terrible idea. And I said on Alex's show a month ago, that I thought Trump would be very bad for markets for that reason.
Just another show of hands so I can work. Oh, yeah. Thank you. I've got some here and here. So can I get a mic here? Sorry, there we go. And
I've got a mic.
Apologies.
Thanks, Sean. So Aaron Banks said Donald Trump got 5 things right. What do you think about Donald Trump?
Look, just you were there, right? It was execution, execution, execution. Says what he's going to do and then
I wasn't actually. Because
that's kind of a summary of it.
Yeah, he was a big fan of Brexit and I was no fan of Brexit. So in fact, when we arrived this morning and I saw the security, I have the pleasure of traveling with my son and we saw the security. I said, oh, look at all the security. And Anthony said to me, that's because of what you said about Trump. So what do I think? Look, I think cutting inefficiencies is a great idea. I mean, I wish they'd do that in the UK and I wish they'd do that here. And finding out that you've got 40,000 software licenses from ServiceNow and it's used by 5 people or whatever the numbers were recently. Well, that's fantastic. We need to cut efficiencies because then what does that mean? It means we don't have to pay as much in taxes. That lowers our costs. That drives economic growth. I think the way in which they're going about it is a bit disruptive. I totally agree with what Adrian Gore said today. And in fact, Anthony again said to me, see, that's how you answer the question. So I thought he said it brilliantly. And I mean, he's a hugely impressive person. And I'm sorry I haven't had the opportunity to meet him. But so I think that focusing on that is good. And I think the other thing which is quite interesting is that China, this is Trump version 2, Trump, China are savvy people. They know how to play this guy. They know what he's going to do with the tariffs. That's why you're not seeing them respond in the same way. So I think cutting the inefficiencies is good. I think he's very divisive and I don't think we need more division in this world. And I really worry that he's going to overstep the mark. And when he oversteps the mark, there's going to be wild protests out there in the US. Okay. And everybody has guns. And it's quite a frightening thought really, because I had a client of mine in 2008 and she was an American, she was an American consultant, and she said, you're very worried about this recession. And I said, why? She says, because you need to understand we all have guns. And so if we're unhappy, it's going to be a problem. And I think that's quite a terrifying thought. So I don't think you want division, because they've got lots of division. And I think what's going on right now with, well, where are the checks and balances? Is this just running? I mean, 100 executive orders and everything's, I mean, it's like, there's just, and the Democrats are saying nothing. And so I think it's risky. So,
we all thought we were living in a horror movie already. Let's just get a question from here.
Thanks, Sean. European defense stocks, do you think there's more upside?
Oh, we see. Everybody's excited about European defense stocks. No, we don't go and we don't get sucked in. You know, where are we? These contracts take a while. We're not buying European defense stocks here. I write on LinkedIn, I write about, my little hashtag is numbers, not narrative. Okay. I don't care what the story is. I'm not overpaying for it. You can be the best. I mean, obesity, these drug stocks, duopoly, fantastic story. If you paid too much for it, you lost a lot of money. Wind energy transition, let's all go and buy wind farms and there's 2 Danish companies and we'll do that. You paid too much money, you lost a lot of money. Okay. So I don't suffer from FOMO. So AI, wonderful story. I'm not paying too much for AI. So we try and play a clever way of, banks benefit from AI because you can cut a lot of costs and you can you can use it for risk management and fraud detection and all the rest. Well, I'm only paying 5x earnings and I'm benefiting from AI. So the defense spending, well, that'll be great for other companies in Europe. Banks will benefit because they'll be advancing loans to companies but we definitely don't chase the story.
Sean, 2 things. 1, do you meet management, kick the tires and so on with your investments? And secondly, could you just tell us about investing in Japan, AGMs, results in different languages? Like, what's your process with Japan stocks?
So thanks, Ant. No, we don't meet management, which is very different again from the industry. A lot of people say, oh, well, how on earth how do you assess it? And Warren Buffett talks about how wonderful management is. The reason I don't meet management is I don't want to bias. And actually, I think I can see what management's done from the numbers. If you go and look at Discovery's growth, okay, and their return on equity and the return on assets and the cash generation, do you really need to meet Adrian Gortiné? He's a brilliant CEO. Look what he's done. It's been amazing. You know, Ryanair, do I need to go and meet Michael O'Leary to know that Ryanair is an amazing manager? No, I can see it in the return on equity and the margins relative to their peers and the balance sheet, etc. So we just prefer the numbers. It keeps me honest. And otherwise, you know, I go and you're the CEO and I go and meet you and then things start falling apart and I think we can't sell the share because Ant's a good guy and I don't want that. I'll be rather impartial. So we don't need management. Also, it's more efficient. And then secondly, on the Japan, you know, these days the Japanese, well, Google Translate, it's amazing, but a lot of the Japanese companies make their presentations and conference call transcripts in English. And we read conference call transcripts and we obviously see what management is saying. And I'll tell you what, one of the key things we look for is when you look at the numbers, I always look at the numbers first and look at the numbers and I go, oof, you know, revenue's falling. And then you read the transcript. I mean, this is of all companies. Okay. So like we always try and read the results and analyze the results of companies, even though we don't own them, because it gives us a sense as to what's happening. So you read the number, you look at the numbers and you think times are tough. And then you read the press release and you think they're just, you know, they were a European defense company where orders are pouring in. You go, well, these guys are deluding themselves. So finding that actually can be quite interesting. The Japanese companies, you know, their results, it's quite interesting. If you go and look at a Japanese company reports, they have to put the number in that block. Okay. They don't have a lot of discretion as to, well, let's design the income statement like this. And no. The number goes in that block. And that's what the number is. And so we quite like it. They're quite clean. They don't have this adjusted EPS. You know, sometimes in US companies, they lost $3 on US GAAP accounting or GAAP in the U.S. internationally. They lost $3. But then if you adjust this and you take out this and you remove that and all the rest, now we actually made a profit. Yeah. Japanese companies don't do that.
Go ahead, sir.
In terms of China, you said you're not looking at the banks and the property. Where do you see the value? And in terms of the electric cars, that in the last month it's like gone up about 50%. The XPeng, the Xiaomi's, the BYD's. Do you follow that?
We don't have any Chinese electric car manufacturing companies or car manufacturers. You know, I think it's quite interesting. Everybody's expecting car sales to fall, but now you've got people shunning Tesla. Well, that means if you're not buying a Tesla, maybe you buy a Porsche, maybe you buy a BMW, maybe you buy a, you know, that kind of thing. So a Mercedes-Benz. So actually you could see a little bit of a shift in that. In China, a lot of the companies, so what have we, I mean, we've got Ping An Insurance, that's one, and you know, they've got, but I'm paying, you know, getting a 6% dividend yield there. We've got Hire. So I don't know if you know the Chinese white goods company where they, you know, and that actually could be quite nicely positioned with this stimulus program that China has underway. They bought the tag, you know, the General Electric, because they're not going to be able to sell Hire washing machines in America. But so they've got the General Electric Fisher Paykel. And they're actually hires, but with those badges. And so much easier to sell a General Electric washing machine in America. So, you know, there's lots of companies in Hong Kong that have been tainted with the wrong, you know, brush, really. You know, it's like, oh, well, just throw it out. But actually, there's diamonds in the dust. We're always trying to find the diamonds in the dust that are being ignored for whatever reason, the innocent bystanders. You know, people don't like China, so they write off the whole of China. Well, hang on, there's some companies that are listed in Hong Kong that are amazing businesses on 5x earnings.
Question from the back there.
Hi, Sean. Any diamonds in India? Maybe?
No, we don't own any Indian stocks directly. You know, again, I don't like to overpay. India's a quite a tricky market. You've got to open an account and pre-fund it and all the rest. So, no, we don't own any Indian stocks directly.
just so that you know what I'm doing in the room, we started at 10 past 12. We're going to take this to 10 past 1.
Okay. I mean, then we've got some companies like Skechers. India's a big market for them, the Skechers. And so you get some indirect exposure there, but no direct exposure.
Go ahead.
Hi, Sean. You talk about bottom-up investing.
Yeah.
Where does your bottom start?
Where does the bottom start? In terms of the size of the companies?
No, just in terms of, you know, Johannesburg's only got about 270 shares. I think Tokyo's got about 4,000. New York is, London's got about 1,700.
Yeah, so one of the things, so if you look at the Bloomberg World Large, Mid and Small Company Index, I think it's about 10,000 companies. So we'll do screens, we use Bloomberg's to screen. But then you say, well, I only want profitable companies. I only want companies with manageable debt levels, not too high a debt level. I only want companies that are growing sales, because if sales are not growing and inflation is high, so if your sales are not growing and your costs are going up with inflation, your profit margins are going to get squeezed. And by the time you do all of that, you know, you're down to a couple of thousand. And people say, well, how on earth do you and a small team of you know 1,000 companies? We don't. That's like saying, how does Rassi Erasmus know all the rugby players in South Africa? He doesn't. He knows, you know, he has a filtering mechanism with the clubs and the schools and all that sort of stuff. And then they go, well, look, I know what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a lock, and he better be 6'5" or whatever. And so we have the filtering mechanism to do that. And then once we've got some of those, you know, you narrow it down a bit further, and then you hand it over to an analyst and you say, well, let's go and look at this thing. Nope. And if it doesn't pass the, if it's not, we don't think we're going to make, if the odds aren't on our side, we're not interested.
That brings us to the, we've got, yes, Cookie Coleman, how on earth could I, now you better have some water. Are you bracing yourself? I saw that hand go up and it was right.
Low expectations. Your slide 6 was fascinating in that, remember that was that one with the periods of European outperformance. And there were two periods up to the tech bubble, the previous tech, the dot-com bubble,
yeah,
and up to the 2000. And it was actually fascinating when you think back, and I thought just for the audience to think about that as well, and what you were saying, the two biggest and most successful companies then in Europe in that dot-com bubble were Nokia and Ericsson. And,
there we go.
You know, at that stage, you couldn't foresee, we couldn't just think that they would. And in the 2007-08, UK was actually very good. It was actually Barclays and Deutsche that were doing the running. And again, so okay, I thought it's actually, it resonated with, by the way, it was a great presentation, really enjoyed it. One question, just you in the UK, UK is a mess.
Yes.
Is it, what do you think of yeah, is it improving or not? And are you looking over there?
No, Cookie, I think you're absolutely right. Just to touch on the stories, you know, you imagine you could have made the case that Nokia was going to be the winner. Smartphones are the future, and Nokia was going to be the winner, or BlackBerry. Okay. And guess what? Smartphones were the future, just wasn't Nokia. And so that's why this buy and hold forever doesn't sit with us, because you've got to be critical and you got to say, am I backing the wrong horse? And if I am, then I need to go and find another horse. So you know, you could have said, well, Zoom, we all Zoom, you know, the pandemic, this is going to change the world. And it has. We're all on Teams and Zoom and all the rest. Well, guess what? Microsoft's closing down Skype. You know, they had a lead, and this is Microsoft. So I think taking these really long-term views is challenging in a very competitive environment. The UK is a mess. And I think it's a mess partly because of Brexit. In fact, I know lots of people who are manufacturing businesses and all the rest. It's a nightmare. You know, things like the creative industries making James Bond movies, and think about all the bands. You know, the bands can't travel over to Europe without endless forms for all their equipment. They've got to itemize every single piece of equipment in the truck. And so what does that make? They don't want to go and travel. And so now the artists are denied foreign revenue. Brexit's been a disaster. So now we've got, you know, you've got the policy of envy on the go, where they've taken away this non-dom thing. So all the rich people are leaving, and you can pay 200,000 euros no matter how much you earn in Italy, and you can ski the Italian Alps and travel the Tuscan vineyards, and you can earn 100 million a year and you'll pay 200,000. That's it. So it's a competitive world. And if they want to chase away the wealthy people, I heard a stat the other day. And it's something like for every millionaire who leaves, you need 400,000 taxpayers to replace them, because they're eating at the fancy restaurants, they're hiring the cars, they're flying in and out in their private jets, and they're paying landing fees, and they're sending their children to very expensive private schools, and so it's a mess. It's a competitive, the world is a competitive place for capital, and capital is leaving there in droves. And so that's why, in response to Oscar's question, I'd love there to be some more inefficiencies taken out. The planning, Chris Pappas was talking about planning and how that does. Well, I mean, you want a slow planning process, come to the UK. It is ridiculous. It is really ridiculous. I mean, I'm involved at a hockey club there, and the costs of planning and all the rest has just been ridiculous. So I don't think things are getting better in the UK, unfortunately.
Talking about Chris Pappas, I loved his response to Aaron Banks as he started his speech, which is basically, you talk about your own country, leave us alone, right?
Yeah. Well, I wish he wouldn't even talk about our country, but anyway.
Anyway, that brings us to the end of this session. And I just want to, for those of you that walked in late, I did it yesterday with Magnus Haystack, is that was a really important metric in the introduction that I put forward, because I think performance speaks volumes. And it's the Morningstar performance metric. So Ranmore, which began in 2008, has returned 16% since inception. And your peer group has returned 7% since inception. And that is over, since 2008, right? So congratulations. I think that deserves a round of applause.
Fun one. Thank you.
Right now, you can get the cheapest Forex rate around, right here, on Shift. Pay less for your dollars, pounds, and euros here. And get to shop more here. And do more here. And enjoy more ooh-la-la here. Shift also lets you trade and transfer currencies and buy shares in the world's best companies. It all happens right here, on Shift. You won't find a cheaper Forex rate anywhere else, no matter where you bank. Download the Shift app today.
In the world of business banking, projections, numbers, and your bottom line can often triumph over relationships. At Investec, we value both. That's why we understand that running a successful business takes endurance, drive, and partners who are willing to walk the journey with you. Make the move from business as usual to Investec Business Banking. Out of the ordinary.
Downings is South Africa's leading marquee infrastructure company, proudly celebrating 25 years of excellence, renowned for creativity, innovation, and unmatched technical expertise. Our event marquees and semi-permanent structures elevate any project with style and sophistication. Whether it's a corporate event or a commercial project, we tailor every structure to meet your needs with world-class precision. Visit downings.co.za to consult with our expert team. Downings, your trusted marquee specialists nationwide.